Talking about it's bubbling. Hey, we are now broadcasting. Hey, folks, thanks for tuning into the Banff Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Lafferty, and today my co-host is none other than Christopher McLaughlin of Green Ronin fame. How you doing, Chris?
I'm great, sir. How are you?
I'm all right. And joining us, we have Jack Herman and Jeff D., esteemed careers in RPGs, both of them. You probably know Jeff D. from Vidlins and Vigilantes, as well as Jack from there. And Jeff, of course, had an auspicious career with TSR as an artist before that. Welcome, guys. Good to have you.
Hi.
Hi, nice to be here.
So before the podcast, we were talking about Bronze Age and comics in the 80s, and you guys had kind of a cool story about sort of your parallel careers in comics back in the day. Could you go into that a little bit?
Oh, yeah. I was going to say, for a while there back in the 1980s, I was working at Kamiko Comics, and Bill Willingham, who created the Elementals title, sort of based off of the early Villains Vigilantes adventures he did for us, Death Duel of the Destroyers, Now the Doctor Apocalypse. He kind of reimagined a lot of that stuff and turned it into the Elementals comic book series. And then after a few issues, I kind of got the gig of writing the scripts for him to do it. And then from there, I wound up getting the gig to write the scripts for their two of their Robotech titles. And Jeff was involved in doing some of the artwork for those as well, for some of the early issues that were pretty cool. Getting to work with him on that stuff.
Oh, cool, cool. You also did Robotech?
Yeah, they had like back in the original back when the TV show was first on the air, they had three monthly titles. One was because they with the Robotech, they took three old Japanese anime titles and kind of edited them together into one long epic saga. So one of them was Macross. The middle one, which I didn't do, was called Robotech Masters, based on I think a show called Southern Cross, and then the third one, which I did for a while, was the Robotech the New Generation, based on Genesis Climber Mospida.
Mospida, yeah, that's the one I worked on as an artist as well.
Yep, yeah. So that was the one where the motorcycles would kind of unfold and kind of go onto the guys' armored robot suits and stuff. So yeah, those were great fun. I was saying before, it was essentially a job where I was getting paid, and my job was essentially to watch cartoons for a living. Where they would send me the VHS of the episodes, I would watch it and then just kind of dialogue the pages based on what they said in the episode. So just about the perfect career for me.
That was pretty much how the art worked on those things too. They would send me videotapes of the episodes that they were the pre-release tapes that had been used when they dubbed the English dialogue, and so there was a time code bar. And literally, I would watch the episode, see how many seconds long it was, and then do a rough breakdown. You know, it's going to be so many pages. How many seconds? Okay, that's about how much action is going to fit on each page. And then I would watch and decide, okay, what's the moment where I want to, that's close to that mathematically perfect breakpoint that would make a good end of the page. And then, you know, I'd do a lot of freeze framing. Had to buy myself a VCR that could do a decent freeze frame, so I could draw from the actual screen. It was interesting.
Your job was much harder than mine, and I remember back in the day buying a VCR that had a good freeze frame was like, that was no cheap thing. that was a good step up in price from the run of the mill junky ones they would sell you.
Oh yeah.
Well, hey. Go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, Jack and I were trying to figure out if we had ever been on the actual same title of that series together, and I don't remember that we ever were. Jack says we were.
Yeah, there was I do remember that we were, because I've got a page of artwork that you actually gave to me from it.
Okay.
And it's definitely one we were working on together.
So what was it like working with Bill Willingham? I was a big fan of Fables, so I'm kind of curious about that.
You know, it's very strange to say that I wrote scripts with this guy who later went on to become like one of the big genius comic book writers of all time. But this was back in the day when he was writing and essentially drawing the book. And it's kind of a grind, and you know, to kind of get those issues in on deadline and stuff. So one of the things that he did is I think he kind of brought me in to basically break the story down into like write a full script version of the plot idea he had, and come and you know write dialogue for it. And it was, you know, at the time, it was probably just about my first comic book work. So I was definitely very much kind of learning on the job. And even then, he had a phenomenal knack of good storytelling. So I learned quite a bit very quickly working on that book with him. It was just basically we would have telephone conversations about what an issue would be like. I would sit down and kind of break it down into, like, at the time... You notice that these days, like, you know, there's, like, less and less pages in comic books. Because when I was doing this, it was, like, 28 pages was an issue, and now about 20 pages is an issue. But, we'd bring it down to 28 pages, and then from there into just panel by panel, and then dialogue it for him, and just kind of write it up in a script format. And that helped him get it done a lot quicker, even though, essentially, he was still the kind of mastermind behind it.
Oh, cool. So, is that era considered Bronze Age, or is that early Iron, or kind of a nebulous blending of the two?
I'm not sure. The Golden Age for me always kind of ended when the EC stuff kind of popped up, and that was kind of like a very clear sign that it was superheroes where interest had turned away from the traditional superhero characters toward more of the horror stuff. To me, Silver Age officially begins, I guess, when you know the Flash shows up again in Showcase, and where Silver Age ends is kind of like a point of discussion. To me, it's like, to me, Silver Age kind of ended when Jack Kirby left Marvel to go to DC. But some people kind of like have that kick that up until like almost the early '80s, like almost like. Secret Wars kind of time. So depending on who you talk to, I don't think there's a hard and fast rule of where that stuff breaks down.
Well, Wikipedia says it's 1970 to 1985, period.
Really?
So, yeah. or some, some idiot that edited the Wikipedia page about that has imposed truth upon us all now.
Yeah, I've heard people say Silver Age goes up until, like, you know, as late as you know, Jim Shooter becoming head of Marvel or that kind of standard. And I don't know. I don't know, man.
Well, Chris, I'm sure you have an opinion on this. What do you say?
Oh, the Wikipedia thing kicked me back for a second because I'm thinking like I've been kind of shaky on Wikipedia since I got in a Wikipedia fight over a guy that created an entry for a book that I wrote and included a blurb about what the author intended, and I included like a one sentence correction. And this guy sat in front of his computer for 12 solid hours redoing my edit. And then he finally asked me, "Who the fuck are you to correct my entry?" And I said, "I'm the goddamn author. That's who I am. I'll tell you what I fucking intended." Pardon my French, but yeah, I've been a little shaky on Wikipedia ever since then. You know, I went with that 1970 date myself because not because Wikipedia said so, but just I was looking at so many things that happened that year, and like you said, with Jack Kirby leaving Marvel, and I found out that was also the year that like National Comics officially and legally rebranded itself as DC Comics, so there was sort of another change over there for that, and that's when the definitive Bronze Age story started, Hard Traveling Heroes, with Denny O'Neil on Green Arrow and Green Lantern.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah. That's a good idea. I mean, and wasn't it, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think back in the day, back in the 60s, didn't DC or National Periodic Publications have some kind of weird monopoly over comic book distribution?
That's very true. That's very true. In fact, Martin Goodman's company almost sank because their distributor went under. And the only thing that kept them going was they had to piggyback on DC's distributor. And DC basically slapped a quota on how many Marvel comics could be published. And that's why so many of the early Marvel comics, it'll be like, like Iron Man and Submariner crammed into one book because they literally couldn't get distributor space to put them in separate titles until they built up enough clout with the success of Fantastic Four and Spider-Man to actually be able to make their own distribution deal.
Because I think so, right around 1970 is when that fell apart, too. I think they got their own Either they work out their own distribution, or that all came to a head right around that same time, I believe.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, I mean, there was never a dull moment with Martin Goodman. That's the more I've researched him, that he's fun.
So, Chris, do you have a favorite Bronze Age comic?
It would be hard to single out at one, and I'll tell you why. Because, like so many things, it's informed by the memories of childhood, growing up in rural Virginia and buying as many Marvel comic books as I could because they were the thing that was least like rural Virginia. And I think, to me, the greatest thing about the Bronze Age was the feel that you got from Marvel Comics. The fact that it was the same handful of writers. It was kind of this revolving chair between, like, Lynn Wein, Marv Wolfman, and Mike Friedrich, Gary Friedrich, and guys like that. And most of them were living in New York at the time. And it didn't seem to matter if, like, you picked up Spider-Man or Daredevil or The Defenders or Fantastic Four or Doctor Strange. But it was like this tremendous mise-en-scene. It felt like you were in New York. I mean, there are splash pages of Spider-Man from that era. It's like you can smell the garbage strike. You know, you can spot, like, David Berkowitz down in the bottom of a panel or something. And, you know, it's just the way that captured the feel of a city that was falling apart. It's almost like, you know, to me, there's a synergy between the opening of a Marvel comic from that era and that great montage of the opening of Dog Day Afternoon. It's hard for me to open a Marvel comic from there and not hear that Elton John music as I'm seeing Spider-Man swing by. It's like, you know, in my mind, he's swinging over, you know, Al Pacino in the street screaming, Attica, Attica. So that all kind of, but, you know, it just captured that era so far. I mean, you know, the little side shots they take at Abe Beam and Ed Koch in those books.
Yeah.
You know, it really did seem to kind of blend into one thing. Now, if two things stand out from that, it would probably be Hard Traveling Heroes, just because that started it all. And, you know, to me, DC, Marvel just kind of captured the beaten and downtrodden and malaise and stagflation of the era. DC was the one that would stand on your chest and scream, message coming in for you, sir. You know, it's like they captured it in the broadest, most grotesque strokes, and I love that immensely. That's the one standout book for me there, because I think that best typifies DC's approach to that. And my other last favorite is being a kid who was raised on the cinema, I developed an overriding fondness for blaxploitation films that I love to this day. You know, the highlight of my summer is I got to see Rudy Ray Moore's Dolomite on a big screen. That, you know, that's how much I love the genre. Wow. And there was something about those early Luke Cage issues. I mean, to a kid my age, you're combining Shaft and superheroes, and as over the top and ridiculous and silly as they are, there's just something that's, they're so of that time. You know, they really do capture the fact that comics is trying to turn into something else, and it's making such a public botch of so much of it. You know, it's so not quite there. That, to me, is kind of the Bronze Age. You know, we're all kind of trying the best we can. So, you know, those are the ones that resonate with me.
Okay, cool. Hey, completely tangential thing. Do you have Netflix?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. Right,
well, there's a, boy, I guess you call it a miniseries, you know, called The Get Down. It's about the birth of hip-hop in New York in that same time frame. You know, it's right around when Ed Koch is just starting to run. And the whole thing kind of feels like deleted scenes from The Warriors. And it's...
Oh yeah, that's a good era, good look.
Yeah, no, it's Baz Luhrmann's the director. Well, he's a producer, so if you don't like his, you know, aesthetic, you're gonna hate it. But it's just when you were rhapsodizing there about New York in the 70s and the feel from Marvel Comics is kind of what it reminded me of. So
yeah,
that I've seen the trailers with the incredible bongo band version of Apache playing over it. That's like, of course, sampled a bazillion times in different things. But yeah, I've seen that. That was pretty cool.
Yeah, it's worth checking out. So, Jeff, you got a favorite Bronze Age comics?
Oh boy, but for me, that's like, you know, when I was in high school and my very early like art school days and stuff. So, and I read everything I could get my hands on, and those were the days when I could just go and buy one of everything on the racks and bring it home and enjoy it. I especially remember, of course, X-Men from that period. One weird thing that stands out that meant a lot to me, this was during high school, when Marvel did Nova, the very first issue of Nova, it just felt to me like, wow, you know, there's this Spider-Man character they've had since forever that was supposed to be a kid, but now he's in his 20s and he's too old for me. And this is the guy that Marvel is inventing to be the kid superhero for me. And I loved it to death for a few issues. And now it's wandered off in some other weird direction. I have no idea what's going on with that character anymore. But yeah, that was special to me. And, you know, as a fantasy fan, loved me some Conan the Barbarian, you know, Buscema and those guys back from the day. But I read everything.
Oh, cool. Jack, how about you?
I have to say I also have been impressed with Denny O'Neil. Just an incredible run from not only this, just the revival of Batman and the Green Arrow, Green Lantern stuff. But just kind of like to bring it up into the 1980s. The two books that really kind of hit me on the head like a hammer in terms of, you know, wow, this is how good comics should be, and this is, if you want to do this, you need to really work the step up your game. The two books that really kind of just gobsmacked me were Grendel by Matt Wagner. When that first came out, even back to its original black and white, the single issue thing they did, which Matt Wagner is probably embarrassed by, but even then, I could see great things in it. I was very impressed by it when I saw it. And to give a shout out to my fellow Robotech writer Mike Barron, when Nexus came out, that was just that someone could do a futuristic superhero comic with the complexity of a really decent science fiction novel behind it. I never stopped being impressed by that book, and glad that it's still kind of lingering on in different forms even today. But yeah, back in the days, back from Capital Comics, and then when First Comics picked it up, I always thought that stuff was amazing.
Cool. Now you got a book that you had a hand in yourself that's from the Time Era coming out here soon, don't you?
Yeah. Back when I was working with at Kimiko. The person actually drawing the book that Mike Barron was writing for Robotech was a guy named Neil Vokes. And back in the day when he wanted to do his own black and white comic, he called me up and got me the right scripts for it. So it came out, was originally published by Rich Rankin, and Rich was the inker on Elementals and buddies with Neil. It was a book called Eagle, which was kind of a futuristic kind of. It was basically everything that we liked. Like if you were to go like pick out a stack of stuff from the video store that you liked and just put it in a blender and pour it out and into a milkshake. It was basically futuristic. Lots of horror stuff. The main character was a martial artist. There were supernatural elements to it, and it was just basically. Every favorite thing from every genre we ever loved all come into one thing, so we had done that for that book for a number of years. Recently, from American Mythology, a publisher there, we actually did a one issue revival of Eagle, and then another one issue revival of a character that spun off from Eagle called Death's Dark Angel. Originally was Death's Head in the first book, but 1 month prior to it being published, Marvel UK put out their book, Death's Head, much better known than ours, and then we got a cease and desist letter, so we had to change his name. So we had that coming out, and then coming out probably just in the next month or so here, a horror anthology book he's doing, which Neil is doing, called Dark Tales of the Volksverse. And since Neil has kind of gone on and become sort of an award-winning horror comics guy, a multiple Rondo Award winner. If you've ever seen the Rondo Award, one of the coolest awards, it's based off, visually it's based off of the old horror actor Rondo Hatton, But
Is it like a bust of him or what?
Oh yeah,
it's kind of a bust of Rondo Hatton. Wow. If you don't know who Rondo Hatton is, you remember the movie The Rocketeer, the big strange looking guy that was the henchman for the mean bad guy. That's Rondo Hatton, or a guy made up to look like Rondo Hatton.
Or if you're a Mystery Science Theater 3000 fan, you may remember when they did the Brute Man.
Yes, exactly. That's right. You know exactly who I'm talking about. All right, this is cool. In the interim, he's done a lot of horror stuff. Like back at Image, he did Black Forest and Wicked West, and I've had the chance to do a couple short stories with him that kind of wound up in various places. So this is kind of an anthology for a lot of his loose, free-floating short stories out there. There's a Wicked West story. I think there's a Black Forest story in there. There was a zombie story he and I got to do for a book called Zombie Bomb, which I think probably very few people have seen. We also did a book for we did a story for a title called Bela Lugosi's Tales from the Grave, that had Bela Lugosi as the actual horror host in it. It was like licensed through the Lugosi estate. It's reprinted in this story, although Lugosi has had to have been removed because it's no longer under that same license. But Neil Drew himself as the host of the story, so that's pretty fun.
And, yeah, you don't want to mess with Bela Jr. in court.
No way. Not that we would want to mess with Bela Lugosi in any version under any circumstance, but. And we did another spin-off from the Old Eagle series, a character called Falconer, that basically is about 100 years before Eagle was running around in his own title. It was kind of like around the turn of the early 20th century. We've got a story where Falconer encounters Dracula, which is pretty cool. So I got to write words in the mouth of Dracula in a comic book. So that was always a fun thing.
And so if I want to get that, how would I get that?
I guess you did just have to go to your comic store and see if they can order it. It's American Mythology is the publisher, so AmericanMythology.net, I think, is their website. If you want to check out some of the stuff online for Eagle, Death's Head, and Dark Tales from the Volksverse coming up. We've got another book that we're working on called Abaddon the Destroyer. That's going to be more of a science fiction superhero-y thing that should come up before the end of the year. Well, I don't know if it's coming up before the end of the year, but it's been solicited, so it's coming out sometime in the future. So maybe end of this year, beginning of next. So, yeah, Neil and I kind of got together, and we just started doing one riff of that after another and just have a long string of projects together now.
Okay, well, sounds like fun. Hey, speaking of fun projects that have a long-running history, that's my awkward segue into Village and Vigilantes.
Let me link that a little more tightly into the previous topic, which by referencing the miniseries that Jack and I did of Villains and Vigilantes comic from Eclipse. First issue was 86, and it ran for 4 issues. So that we actually did a thing together in comics in the Golden Age, Bronze Age.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
My favorite project ever.
It was fun. We would like to do more. So anyway, but we have a game.
We do have a game, Villains and Vigilantes, which lots of drama we won't discuss. But now you guys have the license back firmly in your hands, uncontested, and we're putting out version 3.0.
We have I feel like nitpicking the sentence you just said, but that's not entirely accurate. But we're back to work. And
I was trying to go with the whole. It's back.
It is in fact back. And what we've wanted to do ever since, after years of thinking we would never be able to do anything with our property ever again, discovering that we could, back in 2010, we finally get to move forward and do the thing we wanted to do, which is a proper. Updated version of the game, because it originally came out in 79 and was written when Jack and I were still in high school, And it really, really shows. And 82, we had actually learned some stuff and did a much more solid game. But, you know, it's been several decades since then, and we think we can bring even more to V&V players. So we've really been wanting to do that, and the Kickstarter's running right now to fund the completion.
So, listeners, if you go to Kickstarter.com, just do a search for Village Vigilantes, and it'll pop right up.
In fact, the title is it's Village Vigilantes 3.0, but we didn't want to just have another number, so we're calling it Mighty Protectors, which, by the way, we do have firmly in hand, Mighty Protectors. And if you do a search for Protectors, it's the first thing that'll come up.
All right, well, there you go. Tell us a little bit about the changes you've made this time around to the system.
This will of course make the most sense to people who've actually played earlier versions of the game. What's unique about Villains and Vigilantes is it is an old school style superhero RPG, not exactly a D20 game in the sense people mean nowadays, but certainly had a lot of inspiration from Dungeons and Dragons back in the late 70s, early 80s. So it's random character generation where you actually feel like you're going through an origin story because, you know, a superhero gets a set of powers and then has to figure out, well, what am I going to call myself? A lot of times superheroes won't even necessarily know how they got their powers or you know, what it all means. And so as a player, you get to get these random pieces and figure out, well, if I have these abilities, then I must be a Sunbat or something, right? So that's a unique element of it. And it's got a combat system that is kind of firmly rooted in the way that comic book battles play out rather than physics. So there's a lot of like getting smashed through walls and leaving a U-shaped hole in the wall, but still being alive on the other side. Because that happens. So our rules work that way. So that's where Villains of Vigilantes is coming from. The new game addresses problems arising from the random nature of the character generation. But we always had to say to GMs, look, you know, some people are going to roll up really terrible characters with really terrible powers. So cut them some slack. Let them do more with their abilities than you might have otherwise. Or if they don't have an attack, you know, like let them say, well, I'm going to swing a sword in addition to having the flight and the illusion projection or whatever, right? So they can do something in combat. But it was all very off the cuff. Well, the new game layers a construction system on top of the random generation. So it's got the hooks all in place so that you can tweak your characters after they're randomly generated to make sure you get something good. And also, because of adding that, we now support if people have a concept in mind and want to just build it and not roll randomly, you can do that now. And there's a bunch of other things we've done to just kind of streamline the combat. There used to be a giant lookup table where you'd have to cross-index the type of attack you were using versus all of the kinds of defenses the target had and figure out which one was the best one, and then that was their defense, and that was kind of time-consuming. We've streamlined that now, so combat works a lot faster. And also, we've done things like a power blast. It used to be a flat D20 damage roll, which was kind of all over the place. And now we've moved everything to multiple dice or dice with bonuses so that you get more reliable results. Just trying, making a bunch of little tweaks to improve the experience, improve the likelihood that that you'll get a good character, improve the likelihood that the fights will play out the way you'd hope, and and adding a few new abilities we never had before, and so on. That's at the mechanics end. Jack, you want to talk about what's going in on the world setting end?
You know, this is a campaign that off and on that Jeff and I have been playing in, running for, and writing stuff for, going back to when we were in high school. So this is going back to the back in the days when we got into role playing games because we had the D&D, which were the three little books and the white cardboard box, and of course Jeff with Empire of the Petal Throne. So I don't want to kind of brag on myself or sound too egotistical about it, but this is really a setting, like a world setting, that's been decades in development. So it's pretty much unlike just about anything else you could see in superhero role playing games. And we've got lots of world to tell, lots of some pretty amazing stuff, lots of great stories to tell. And when we did it, Villains and Vigilantes originally, we kind of really thought of all players and all campaigns kind of the way we did it, and that was we generally didn't run pre-written adventures, or we didn't buy like the campaign setting. We made up our own setting, and at the time we were kind of naive enough to think, oh, that must be what everybody does.
Yeah, well, like the way that D&D worked, right? D&D didn't come with a setting. Every game master made their own, and that's kind of what we thought was happening with Villains and Vigilantes originally.
And, you know, people looked at the art that we put in the game. People read the rules and character names that we would reference and examples of play and things like that. They'd say, well, what's that guy's story? Where, you know, what's that character there? What happened in the game when he did that? And little by little, we kind of realized, oh, well, you know, we need to kind of share that and kind of develop our own world. We started to do that a little bit with the second edition when we had our introductory adventure that went into detail about the characters, the Crusaders, and the Crushers, which were this band of villains that, you know, screw plot and the major scheme and all that kind of stuff. These guys just really hated each other and liked to fight. So we kind of got a little bit more of putting together a world for V&V, starting with the stuff that came out with the second edition. And when we did the comic book, that kind of was the first real, in my mind, the first real look at this is, at least as far as Jeff and I are concerned, this is what this world looks like from our point of view. And we tend to give you a lot more of that with this, because the Mighty Protectors is really the name that we have for our setting. It's kind of the branding of the setting of the campaign Jeff and I have been running since 77, 78.
Yeah, back in high school, Jack and I would like take turns GMing. So we each had a character in the Protectors superhero team, and you know, 1 week Jack would run, and the next week I would run, and that went on until I went off to art school. But so it's a setting that we developed together that we never really got a proper introduction to the players, because, like I said, we thought that wasn't the important thing, that people would use this as a generic superhero game. Well, in 2010, when we discovered that we could publish our game ourselves, we came out with V&V 2.1 in 2010, and it was all basically the same text as the 1982 edition, but with some additional material and some stuff cleaned up, and all new illustrations. And this time, knowing that people actually cared about this stuff, and, you know, after decades of going to conventions and people opening up the book and pointing to a character, who's that? We actually put captions with the illustrations, and realized at that point that the game was going to be start to be more firmly rooted in our universe as we saw it. So that's really happening a lot with Mighty Protectors.
Okay, cool. So I see you guys are already funded. So this is going pretty well.
Oh yeah, we're unlocking stretch goals now.
What kind of stretch goals are you unlocking?
Well, the very first one was just a simple little thing, you know, to get the ball rolling. It was a ref screen. Mm-hmm. So we've got that like practically day, I don't know, 2 or 3 or something. Then we have a longtime Villains and Vigilantes adventure writer. Who am I thinking? Is this Stephen Dedman. He wrote some of the old-time V&V adventures that you may recall. We've had a manuscript from him for a while because in 2010 we thought we were back in business, and then there was a legal problem. But so we've been sitting on some stuff for a while. Well, we wanted to get his next adventure out in front of the public. It's called Market Forces. It's kind of a gritty street level kind of thing, wouldn't you say, Jack? So yeah, it's like drug dealers and stuff, international drug cartel with supervillains. And then the next stretch goal after that is the War Heroes source book. It's a giant World War II source book for our Mighty Protectors game, actually written by Brian Adams, who was he's a friend of mine down here in Austin, who has run a 5-year-long playtest campaign for the new rules, just played the heck out of the system, and he wanted to run a campaign starting at the dawn of World War II, so we did that, and I was one of his players, and it went on long enough that we actually came out the other end of World War II, and our characters have rolled into the 50s now. We're just at the point where McCarthy is going after superheroes trying to get us all unmasked, and he documented everything from his many year long campaign, and also wrote up like an optional ultra low powered campaign where you can make guys that are sort of like the Howling Commandos. They're not really superheroes, but each guy has got like a little specialization. My character was the Red Bear. I was the Russian member of the team, just kind of a big strong guy. I could pick up and throw motorcycles, which was impressive. So that was the next thing that was unlocked, and we're working now on unlocking Jack's new introductory adventure. You want to talk about that, Jack?
The adventure for the second edition of V&V was Chrysler Crusader Citadel, which was kind of just a basic. Here's a superhero team headquarters, but they've been captured by a bunch of villains. Go in there and rescue them. This one is going to be a little bit more epic in that it involves a plan to overthrow the United States. And other than that, I don't want to give too much of it away.
No.
It's going to involve a group of villains that are archenemies of the Mighty Protectors, which is the main superhero team of this world, and they're kind of based off of a lot of the old players we've had and the new characters we came up with to be part of the team as well.
You know, it's funny when we've had the opportunity to do the comic book. You know, Jack and I had long discussions about what should it be, and it needed to be Villains and Vigilantes, of course. But we talked a lot about the idea of basing it in our campaign with our characters, and we decided that was just a little bit cheesy, and that it wouldn't really necessarily lead to the best results. So instead, we rolled up Shatterman and Condor, who became this duo who went through the Crisis of Crusader Citadel adventure together. That's the 4 issues of the comic book. And that was great for that. But I think after many decades, and like Jack mentioned, we still run games. When we run V&V, it's still in the same universe, but we haven't really run the Protectors as a team for decades, because we moved apart and our group members moved away and stuff, and that team is over in our as far as live players playing those roles. And I think that's finally given us the breathing room to step back and say, well, how do we take the best ideas from what came out of that campaign and re-present those and reconstruct the whole thing that, in a way that would make a good story and a good product. So so we're back to doing that.
Okay, now I didn't know you guys were doing a new Villains of Vigilantes comic. When's that coming out? How do people get that?
Oh, wait, where did you hear this?
I thought that's what you just said.
Oh no, we've named the game after the Protectors, and we're putting the Protectors front and center. I mean, when we actually, I remember back when, you know, we were playing in the campaign in high school, the Protectors were like, we're the snot-nosed kid, like newcomer superheroes in this world where there's other established teams, and you know, it was a lot of stories were about. You know, were we getting better press than the Nucleus team in New York City or the Justice Defenders out on the West Coast? You know, now after many, many decades going back and revisiting those characters as comics creators and as game creators, more importantly, we've upped the Protectors to be like the main guys of our universe now, because they're the team that's been around the longest.
Okay, I misunderstood what you were saying. I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, no, that's we're making a big deal out of the Protectors in the game now, in a way we never used to before. I guess that's my point.
Okay, cool.
We would of course love to do more comics, wouldn't we, Jack?
Absolutely.
And we may have secret plans for a thing like that, but nothing that we've announced.
We cannot confirm nor deny the secret plans.
I know every once in a while I bug Chris and the guys at Green Ronin about doing some kind of comic with their universe, and it doesn't. I know Steve Long did some short stories for a Hero System setting. Do you think there's a lot of carryover between people's enthusiasm for reading a comic or fiction set in the same section, the same universe they role play in?
I think there is. I mean, the licensed properties in comics now are a thing, right? That's pretty common, and they do reasonably well. And this is just another example of that. It's just that instead of being based in some movie or novel or TV series, that these are based in characters that you've learned about from a game you played.
One of the things I liked about the original V&V comic book is we took the introductory adventure and we just kind of basically did a comic book adaptation of that story over the four issues. And then for years, and I think probably to this day still, we run into people that are like, oh yeah, well, Shatterhand and Condor did this, and they did this well and got through with that. But when we played, we did much better because we went this other way. Instead, we fought this guy and did this. So in a way, it was kind of like, since a lot of people played that introductory adventure, seeing the adaptation of it, it was sort of like getting to watch. I mean, you know how like on Twitch, people just watch each other play games now. It was getting a chance to watch another group play through that adventure that they had played through. So a little meta from back in the 1980s, I guess.
Sure. And, you know, it goes both ways. I mean, there have been and are Marvel and DC licensed RPGs out there now where the whole point is playing your characters in amongst those established universes. And that's perfectly fair, too.
Yeah, I believe my co-host Christopher McLaughlin was one of the primary writers of the last version of the DC RPG.
Yeah, well, I got all the old weird characters. If they didn't really know who the character was, they got assigned to me. That's how that worked.
that's pretty cool. There's a lot of great old weird DC characters. So,
did you get Ragman? Ragman is my favorite weird DC character.
I did not get Ragman for reasons that I think I can tie this podcast in a nice bow. Oh. When he had the major comeback with Bill Willingham writing him, mm-hmm. he got lumped in with the Shadow Pack book. I was hoping to get him as an individual entry, but they were only doling out Shadow Pack as a team. And so I missed out on that, unfortunately, because I didn't get the team entry. No, I got guys like Amos Fortune and the Royal Flush Gang and the Top. I remember there was one point where I had three legal pad pages covered with every trick Top that he had used in his entire career, and I realized this is either the coolest thing ever or a cry for help.
I think I need help too, because I was thinking to myself, wow, I'd like to see that. That sounds pretty cool.
There's no reason it can't be both.
Yeah. Thank you. And to my editor, John Lighthouser's credit, he only had to cut two of them for space reasons. Oh. So, it's one thing to be crazy and then meet somebody else that shares your madness. That's a really special moment.
I'm just imagining if someone's running that character where the players are fighting the Top and then they beat him and he's lying there going, if only I had those other two Tops.
So that was a great experience, a lot of fun.
Cool.
I think most of the characters for that got cut except for Sonar. Actually, Sonar was the one who got cut. I had the Silver Age Sonar, who's a minor Green Lantern villain no one cared about.
You know, this must be a conspiracy, because they cut the original Tattooed Man after I did him.
Well, the revision of the Tattooed Man was a much more interesting character.
But, I don't know. The later things they did with the Abel Tarrant version, I thought were pretty interesting, especially like when they were showing him later in books only. I remember like Kronos. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought that grabbed me a lot more than the two appearances that the new guy made that I can actually remember.
Oh, you're talking about the new 52 guy?
No, they had a new one that came in with, oh my god, which earth-shattering crossover was it? Final Crisis. They brought in a second one, and he lasted about as long as everything else from Final Crisis lasted.
Oh, I forgot about that guy.
Yeah.
You know, I hate to say it sounds cynical, but there's been so many DC, what's the plural of crises?
It seems
like crises is enough, though, like I should say, you know, crisis I, because there's so goddamn many of them. It just kind of all becomes a blur, and I'm like, oh yeah, this guy was revised, and there was a new take on that villain, and this other thing, and... Oh, fuck, I just don't care anymore. But
Well, you know, French filmmaker Jacques Barzun once defined a culture that is just doing the same things over and over and over again because it's lost its ability to create anything new as decadence. So we could just call them decadence.
I like that.
Thank you. Classy. Thank you. And French.
Even classier. Just like snails and garlic butter. That's some classy shit right there. All right, guys. Well, hey, we are coming up on the 60-minute mark, and I've got to get back to the directives of my slave-driving wage masters. Hey, before we go, I would be amiss if I did not say, and Chris, maybe you should have mentioned this, Mutants and Masterminds right now, Bundle of Holding.
Yes, indeed.
It's for a good cause. It's for charity, and you can get a whole bunch of Mutants and Masterminds books at bundleofholding.com. Check it out.
And you'll find some of my words in there.
Yep. And go to Kickstarter.com, search for the Mighty Protectors, Original Villains of Vigilantes, and this Kickstarter is already funded. It's a sure thing, and I'm liking cool. Steve Jensen's a backer, so, you know.
At every backing level, there's free PDFs you'll get, because they've been all unlocked, so, yeah.
And back to the guys who inspired me and so many others to want to do this.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, cool. Hey, Jeff, Jack, anything else you want to say before we wrap it up?
I think I'm done. Anything else you wanted to mention, Jeff?
Well, let me throw in, since some of my other games were mentioned in passing, that I have Jack and I are Monkey House Games. We do the Villains of Vigilante stuff, but my other company is Unigames. That is me and my partner, Talshamir, and we've done Baethorm, the new Empire of the Petal Throne game, and also the Cavemaster game. You can find us at unigames.us.
Okay. Hey, I guess I should ask, because I'm wondering, is there any kind of third-party license for Villains of Vigilantes, if a third-party producer wanted to make something?
We can talk about a third-party license for Mighty Protectors.
So nothing's written down yet, but it's being considered, or?
Yes.
Okay,
totally contact us offline.
Gotcha, gotcha. Okay, well, for anyone who's curious, that's what you do. And listeners, thanks for tuning in, and we will catch you next time on the Banff Podcast.
Thanks for having us. Bye, everybody.